Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm Jon Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vietor.
On today's show, Nikki Haley hits Donald Trump hard and promises to stay in the race through Super Tuesday.
Hell yeah.
And Joe Biden gives a fiery speech in South Carolina and puts together a campaign strategy that includes Taylor Swift. That's right. We're going to include Taylor Swift in the opening just to get those numbers up.
Get that Kansas City NFL traffic.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that there's a whole conspiracy theory that the Super Bowl was scripted because Outback Steakhouse had a poster that said Kansas City Chiefs versus San Francisco 49ers a couple weeks ago?
I did not know about the Outback. Was that a poster from 2020 when they played each other in the Super Bowl?
I don't know. I obviously don't know.
They were pushing on an open door with this. There's a lot of NFL rigged conspiracy theories. There was a rumor out there that there was an actual script written that someone had gotten their hands on.
Vague thinks it was a deep state thing that the Chiefs are going to the Super Bowl and Taylor Swift.
I don't think it's rigged, but the NFL is definitely like,
whoa,
hell yeah, thank God.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It's
capitalism. That's not
exactly
which is also often.
And she can get here in time from Tokyo.
Yeah, she can. She gets a private plane. She's Tokyo Saturday night. She's got to fly right after that, and then she's got to go right to Vegas.
Okay.
But first, the big issue in Congress and the 2024 campaign right now is immigration. We talked last week about Trump trying to kill the bipartisan deal to secure the border so that Republicans can run on that issue. The whole party's doubling down on that after President Biden endorsed the deal, said that it would give him emergency authority to shut down the border when it becomes overwhelmed, and promised to do that the day he signed the bill into law. Trump called the deal a political gift to Democrats, told a crowd in Las Vegas that he wants the blame for killing it, and praised Speaker Mike Johnson for saying the deal would be dead on arrival in the House. Republicans are instead attempting to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas for not addressing the border crisis, even though he's the guy who helped negotiate the bipartisan deal to address the border crisis. Meanwhile, the lead Republican negotiator in the Senate, Oklahoma's extremely conservative James Lankford, who was condemned by his own state party over the deal, went on Fox and called out his colleagues for playing politics.
It is interesting. Republicans 4 months ago would not give funding for Ukraine, for Israel, and for our southern border because we demanded changes in policy. So we actually locked arms together and said, we're not going to give you money for this. We want a change in law. And now it's interesting, a few months later, when we're finally getting to the end, they're like, oh, just kidding. I actually don't want a change in law because it's a presidential election year. We all have an oath to the Constitution, and we have a commitment to say we're going to do whatever we can to be able to secure the border.
So we'll get into the politics in a second, but what's your take on the deal based on what's been reported so far? I know we don't have text of the deal yet.
Well, yeah, we don't have it. First of all, the Oklahoma Republicans are denouncing him for a deal they have not seen. Mm. It doesn't exist on paper. We were right before recording, like looking around to find if there was anything with more than a few sentences and kind of passed on descriptions of it. Like Biden refers to it in a statement. Reporters have vague details in their stories that they've probably gotten from staffers and senators. So, you know, basically all we know is that there's what amounts to a conservative border proposal that has been sort of negotiated between Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, we have like the vaguest of details.
Yeah.
He got in trouble for the sin of negotiating with Democrats in the first place.
Yes.
I mean, we sort of know the broad strokes deal, right? They're going to, that if border crossings get to a certain level, then Biden would be required to shut down the border.
If it gets over an average of 5,000 people a day for a week, or I think if it spikes to one day of 8,500 crossings, you can suspend asylum screening at non-official ports of entry.
Mm-hmm. And that's a rate that's been hit most days in the past month.
Yes.
Yes. And there's also just going to be funding. There might change the timeline for getting your asylum hearing. Right now, it's like up to a year, but they're going to try to bring that down to 6 months because part of the problem is there's just not enough judges and the hearings are taking too long.
Not up to a year. Years.
Yeah.
Years. They want to get it down from years to 6 months.
Yeah.
They're going to try to do more work permits because another issue that's happening is when people claim asylum and then they're released into the country, they can't get jobs anywhere because they don't have work permits. So that's an issue they're trying to fix as well. So that's sort of the broad strokes of the deal. The Republicans are saying that because it's up to 5,000 a day to close the border down, that basically that Biden and the people supporting this deal want to let in 5,000 a day.
Yeah, that is a permission. That it's a number. The idea that we're like sitting and be like, Lankford, a right winger, has been, and they sent him to do this. They sent him to his death to go do this.
The American Conservative Union in 2020 named James Lankford the second most conservative senator in the United States Senate. This is the squish. This is the liberal squish who's betrayed the Republicans on this deal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the guy, but he does seem like he's sincerely trying to lead a process to solve the problem. You know, I heard him talk about what his final bill would look like, and he basically thought he could put together something that would get half Democrats and half Republicans and get to maybe 70 votes.
Yeah.
But he's talking about something. It is a real problem. I mean, I heard Lankford say in an interview that in 2010, 21,000 people applied for asylum on the southern border. The U.S. now sees that number in 2 days. So you can understand how the system is just completely overwhelmed and overtaxed. And you have this perverse incentive where people know that if you apply for asylum, you can get released into the U.S. and basically wait out your asylum hearing for years and years and years. But that has led to, you'll have people flying from Uzbekistan to Mexico to pay a cartel or a trafficker to take them to the border. And no one thinks that that's how the process should go, because if you're coming from Uzbekistan, you're going through all these other countries where you could seek asylum if you actually had a political concern or need.
Yeah, it's tough to understand the extent of the crisis, because for so long Republicans have used Fox and everything else to make people think that we're getting invaded by immigrants, right? That's their whole shtick. But last month, illegal border crossings in from Mexico were the highest ever recorded in history, over 300,000 in December. And so Border Patrol, immigration courts completely overwhelmed, migrants and asylum seekers waiting forever for hearings. They're getting bused to cities that do not have the resources to help them. They cannot get work permits. So the current system isn't working for anyone, including migrants.
Right. You have people who have sincere asylum needs who can't get a hearing.
Yeah. The Biden administration also put in place this, they had an app so that you could, instead of coming to the border, in your home country, you could try to schedule at a port of entry an asylum hearing. And the wait times just for that app, sometimes 3-4 months just to get through, because the demand is so high, because there's just so many people. So it's just a mess.
Yeah, it was also a mistake, I think, to push that U2 album as part of the app.
Timely joke there.
Wow. Okay. Aging millennial.
Well, everyone's aging, John. Find me a person who isn't aging.
He's got a good point.
That is a good point. So immigration activists are angry with Biden for saying he'll shut down the border. I would say that, as Tommy mentioned, they're still going to allow people to apply for asylum at ports of entry. And because there's a Republican House, the choice is not between a deal and a better deal. It's between this deal and the status quo, which the vast majority of Americans, elected officials of both parties, people in border communities and now big cities do not want. They want to get control of the border. The polling is very
terrible. And by the way, and the polling shows that I think it's between, it depends on the poll, but let's say between 55 and 60% when asked prefer Republicans to Democrats on the border. It's also an issue in which Republicans feel they have an advantage, and having Biden in a position to be making this deal is one we'd prefer than Donald Trump making this deal.
There's also a lot of money in there for Border Patrol, but also immigration judges, asylum officers, so people to actually process these claims and try to help people, get heard. There's also, it would provide green cards for refugees from Afghanistan who are in the U.S., so that's another important wrong the administration is trying to right through this process.
Yeah. And just to come back to the polling for a second, it's wild. I was surprised by this too. So immigration, when you ask people what their top issue is, immigration has always been sort of up there for Republicans, at least in the last several years in the Trump era. It's now getting to be the top issue for voters. In a couple polls, it was the number one issue. It's now overtaking inflation as a big issue. And YouGov was out with a poll today. And this was not a small sample. It's 40,000 adults. And they asked the question, do you support or oppose building a wall? Oof. Support 50%, oppose 33%, with plurality support from the following groups: 18 to 29-year-old voters, Black voters, Hispanic voters, basically every single demographic group they tested except for registered Democrats. It wants a fucking wall, which is, first of all, is bad and would not solve the problem and is just ridiculous.
Waste of
but
money.
So if that's the polling on the wall, imagine the polling on, at least secure the border.
Yeah, the and I do think on this issue and a bunch of other issues, I do think there is a broader recurring theme, which is the more people feel like a problem is out of control, not well maintained, that there's a sense of danger, the more conservative their responses get on other issues related to it. If people feel that crime is high, they want more funding for the police. If people believe the border is a mess, their immigration positions move to the right. And so there is a connection between wanting a long-term, humane, compassionate, open, welcoming society and a set of policies that put Biden in a position to say the border is more under control or, you know, on the path to being kind of protected, whatever.
I bet people also support the wall because it's the only policy solution they've heard about for the past decade, right? Because our immigration system is this confusing, dated patchwork of laws and processes, and Trump is offering them a very simple one, a simple fix. We're going to build the wall and we're going to lock people out, right? And like that kind of populist demagoguery is highly effective, especially when you're demagoguing groups or just attacking, you know, government that's not working.
And again, people's views on the border are very different than people's views on legal immigration and what to do about the tens of millions of undocumented immigrants who are already here and who've been here for a while. The majority of Americans still want a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who are here, and they want more legal immigration. It's just that the border, and now that the border problem has not just become an issue for border communities, but for cities all across the country, that has pissed a lot of people off and they want it fixed. So I don't see how this gets done now, because Johnson said it was dead on arrival in the House. I don't even know if it will pass the Senate at this point, because I don't think a lot of Senate Republicans might not want to take a hard vote if they know that it's not going anywhere in the House. But I don't know. Do you guys see any way this gets done?
First of all, it's just amazing that this has become a hard vote.
I know we should talk about like the Trump of
this
it all.
This is fucking wild. Like, this border debate is a concession to a concession. This is a border debate that was made necessary by Republicans insisting on it in order to pass funding for Ukraine. Now what has become then, and then inside of that border negotiation, you have Democrats and the Biden administration conceding on a number of grounds to get to a bipartisan compromise that can conceivably pass both houses. And the idea that like a border control measure that they sought out, that is ultimately like, you know, I am sure that that Democrats that are part of the negotiation are fighting hard to make it as humane, compassionate, you know, as much funding as possible to fix the judicial process, to fix the asylum system and what have you. But ultimately, like, this is the nation of laws part of the immigration reforms. There's also the nation of immigrants part that is mostly outside of this conversation. And the idea that that's become a hard vote is just such a testament to the kind of like control Republicans have had, and why you've seen Romney, but even people like Langford, who are normally not this outspoken against Republicans, saying like that this is a joke.
Well, a lot of them have realized that saying we don't want to do this deal because it would help Joe Biden and Donald Trump wants to, our boss Donald Trump wants to run on it. They realize that that's probably not the smartest thing
that's
to
the
say.
Quiet part
some of
loud,
them have
yeah.
said, yeah, some of them have realized that. Others have not, including Donald Trump. But now their complaint is, and Mike Johnson said this in his statement, that and Trump's been saying this too, Biden doesn't need a bill to close the border, that Biden right. should be able to do this on
which
his own, which is just a lie. During the Trump administration, Trump and Johnson both wanted Congress to pass legislation that gave Trump the authority to close the border. Most of the executive actions that Trump took on his own to deal with the border were overturned by the courts. And also, by the way, while Trump successfully reduced legal immigration during his 4 years, thanks to Stephen Miller, he didn't really succeed at reducing illegal immigration by much at all. And partly because he tried to do all these fucking executive actions on his own, didn't work with Congress, the courts overturned them, and that was that.
And by the way, before they've discovered this idea that the president could have solved this on their own the whole time, even though this is a decades-long problem that no president's been able to solve of either party, you had Cornyn going out there saying Greg Abbott wants a bipartisan bill to pass because he can't wait a year for there not to be these policies in place. Like, they knew, like, they before they discovered that the president could do this without legislation, the critique they were trying to dampen was the idea that Trump could do a better deal. And so before they even got to the idea that they didn't need a law at all, they thought that what they had to do was convince people they couldn't get a better deal under Trump. So this is an idea they've come up with in the last, what, week and a half?
It also just doesn't make sense. It's like, oh, if you think the president doesn't need the authority, then what's your problem with the bill? Just pass the bill. If you want to do a stronger bill, Donald Trump, if you become president, then you can do a stronger bill then. Like, what are you fucking talking about? It doesn't make any sense. Ugh. So Biden and the Democrats want to flip the politics on this issue by making sure Trump and Republicans get the blame for refusing to help do something about the border. You guys think that's doable? Any ideas what they should be doing?
I mean, it's going to take a huge messaging push. I think it's doable. I mean, because you have the Trump comments, right? You have Lankford saying what we heard the clip earlier that he's basically saying Republicans are changing their minds on this. There was a Republican congressman from Texas who said he's, quote, not willing to do damn much right now to help a Democrat and to help Joe Biden's approval rating. Again, reading the stage directions there. There's all these reports about Mitch McConnell's comments that Trump is trying to kill the bill. So the challenge is it's going to be an uphill climb for Biden because of the political context we talked about earlier. There was an ABC News Washington Post poll that had Biden at an 18% approval rating on the issue of immigration. So people are disinclined to trust him on this. And you will have to convince some very skeptical people that you care about the issue, that you're on it, that you're sincerely trying to fix it. But I do think you have to try because Republicans have handed you a political gift here by being so ham-handed and stupid about their actual motives.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I'd lean in really hard on this because most people only think that, you know, Trump and Republicans are tough on the border and Biden's just presided over a mess. That's all they think. And they're not following the details of this. I would run ads. I would give speeches. If I was Joe Biden, I'd call them out in the State of the Union. That's a pretty big audience and they're sitting right there. Yeah. Have them yell back at you.
Absolutely.
And make it a moment. Like, they're giving us so many quotes, like some of the ones Tommy read. J.D. Vance said, we're going to take a vote that only harms us politically. That's why he doesn't want to do it. Donald Trump has been saying it. You've got Lankford, the clip that we played of Lankford being like, yeah, my fellow Republicans are just not solving the problem. Nikki Haley has been doing it.
And this is not the first time these cowards have seen the politics on immigration reform and then decided to cave. In 2013, there was a big bipartisan effort led by Marco Rubio until, he saw the politics and decided to blame it on Obama and say he was walking away from the deal because he didn't trust the administration to implement the policy that he didn't have the courage to try to put forward anymore.
The difference between that 2013 proposal and this proposal, like, these are light years apart. That was a comprehensive immigration plan that had a path to citizenship as part of it. And so they did, and the politics had shifted. This was like the post-autopsy where Republicans thought they were going to appeal to moderates and Hispanics by shifting on this and a bunch of other issues. And then Donald Trump shows up and they realize they can't. We are so fucking far from that. My hope too, by the way, is that some of these Republicans in the Senate are so fucking pissed that they still bring this to a vote and go along with passing it. Because I do think it matters. Like, I am sure there's going to be a lot of pressure to make sure that this is just a Democratic vote, right? And that no Senate Republicans go along with it. And maybe they would rather not, right? It's an easier vote. If they're at the point where this is going to be dead in the House and you have, whatever, 38, 39 Republicans willing to vote against it, like, you know, can they get Republican votes? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess they need 10 because it's, you know, it would be filibuster. You'd have to deal with the filibuster. So,
right. What I'm saying is, if they're at the point where they think they have 4 or 5, 6 or 7,
right?
Are
no,
they
no,
get
no,
any?
I know.
I just don't think they'll get all the Democrats. There's a bunch of Democrats already said they're opposed to this
in the Senate that are going to vote no.
I don't think Bernie would vote for this. I mean, there's a bunch of progressives that think this is too draconian.
Yeah, it's gonna be tough.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of Bonnie plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all Bonnie 4.5-inch vegetable and herbs are on sale through May 17th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
So one of the few Republicans who's attacking Trump for killing the deal is Nikki Haley, who's hitting Trump on everything these days. She's apparently decided to make the next month as miserable as possible for Trump, which we love. Haley said over the weekend that she's staying in the race through Super Tuesday on March 5th, and that she doesn't need to win South Carolina, her home state, just show improvement. Sure, whatever.
I love it.
That's great. But she also...
Maybe she's a millennial.
But she also spent the weekend laying into Trump. She weighed in on the E. Jean Carroll verdict and accused him of being an insecure, overly sensitive establishment insider who's in decline and can't stop throwing tantrums. Let's listen.
He was a bit sensitive, and I think his feelings were hurt, but he threw a temper tantrum out on stage. Seriously, threw a total temper tantrum.
Look, I mean, he can't bully his way through the nomination. I think that, you know, it's not surprising that he is surrounded by the political elite. But let's keep in mind, the political elite has gotten nothing done for us in stopping the wasteful spending, has gotten nothing done to secure the border, has gotten nothing done to keep us more safe as we see wars around the world. I absolutely trust the jury, and I think that they made their decision based on the evidence. I just don't think that should take him off the ballot. I think the American people will take him off the ballot. I do think that he is in decline, and I think that he needs to know to step away. I do think that he surrounds himself in chaos, and we can't be a country in disarray and have a world on fire and be in chaos.
Isn't it sad that it's like quite notable breaking news that an elected Republican trusts the justice system?
Yeah, I know. Also, Trump absolutely can bully his way to the nomination, and she definitely needs to win South Carolina.
He may already have.
As much as I enjoyed that supercut, come on, Nikki. I mean,
what do you think she's up to here? Do you think she thinks she can actually win?
This is the part of the campaign, the kind of like pre-South Carolina moments where the candidates, they unburden themselves and they let rip. And I think part of it is go for broke. Let's see if this harsher message works. Part of it is probably just cathartic, right? I mean, this is around when in late February of 2016, Marco Rubio started cracking jokes about Trump's penis, for example.
That was well for
a very high-minded policy debate. Yeah. Trump has also screwed up a lot recently. He's given her some fodder here. I mean, confusing her with Nancy Pelosi is not normal.
A rare miss for Trump.
A rare miss. Some of this is just an amped up version of what she's been saying. Like, she's been making an age argument. She's been talking about the chaos, but it's a lot more pointed now.
Yeah, I was going to say, remember, the chaos used to be the chaos follows him around. Yeah, yeah. Now it's like, passive he voice. Loves chaos.
Well, it's interesting. That was so strange about it, is that, like, that you know, there's parts where she sort of still has the kind of careful avoidance of certain lines. Like when she describes the E. Jean Carroll verdict, she says she trusts the jury. But in her campaign speeches, she makes it much more about, you know, when he's out there talking about this verdict, he's not talking about inflation. He's not talking about the jobs, whatever. And so it's less about the moral and ethical horror that he represents and more like the politics and the distraction, right? So there's still those lines. But then she says he's in decline. And not only that, I don't know if it's purposely going further, if it's just organically gone further than she was before. She now said in the speech, the country cannot afford 4 years of Biden or Trump, that the country won't survive it, right? That is going much further. So
is that a debt argument, though? Is that a literal debt thing? She's hitting him on debt.
That was a broader point that leads into when she says the part about President Kamala Harris. So it was like,
she's trying to get Simpson and Bowles.
That's fair. No, that's good. Hey, that was good. But so it's like, that's a new, to say the country will not survive 4 years of Trump is like, now, but you also won't say that you're following the cases closely. It's strange.
So I feel like she is smart enough to know that she simply cannot win more delegates than him at this stage. Like, I don't think
one would hope. Yeah.
But if she
doesn't want to win South Carolina, then probably.
But if she goes through Super Tuesday and picks up a bunch of delegates and he gets convicted before the convention and his polls versus Biden crater, then she's the candidate with the next most delegates. And maybe she thinks she wins it there. It's basically the Dean Phillips strategy. It's basically what he told us, you know, that he's like, we'll see what happens in the convention if the polls are all, you know.
Yeah. There were two other things that came across. One is, it's really interesting when she talked about all the South Carolina politicians that endorsed Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, like the person I beat. Oh, like the legislators who I came after for not recording their votes and for being basically corrupt. Oh, and Tim Scott, well, I'm not going to talk about that. He has to live with his choices. And so
she's like, I'll let you all deal with Tim Scott.
Yeah, I'll let you all deal
with that.
But what I took is like,
made fun of Lindsey Graham too.
Yes, like who cares? Who wants Lindsey Graham on their side? So like, there does feel like a little bit of like a local, like, fuck these people.
Yeah,
I am pissed and this is my state. That was the first thing. The second piece of it is, it was true when she declared victory in Iowa, also true when she declared victory in New Hampshire. There is a, like, there, she is sharp and she is sharpening. And like, I watched the speech she just did in South Carolina. It is a ton of like details, facts, numbers. She's like on her game. She's hitting her points. The audience is like really engaged with her. There does feel, I do think she's getting feedback. And because I think she's sharpened her message, it no longer feels like a politician's slog and a set of message points. You do feel like there's a genuine kind of purpose to the campaign, even though it's a, you know, all likelihood a fool's errand. But like, I do think that's like propelling it a little bit. There's like a real thing happening.
Yeah. Lose by 20.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
But, my special purpose.
But she's making that electability electability argument. And like, yeah, maybe she's hanging on for a bad verdict, but maybe also like a couple bad polls that start to make that electability argument get a little bit more purchase. I don't know.
I do want to talk a little bit more about her answer on the E. Jean Carroll verdict, because we haven't been able to talk about that yet, because it happened late last week. Donald Trump is an adjudicated rapist who a jury decided owes the woman he assaulted $87 million for defaming her. That plus the ruling in New York State's the civil trial, the business fraud that the New York AG has brought against him, could put a serious dent in his net worth.
Yeah, that one can go up to $370 million. I was talking to a friend who was a clerk in the New York City courts and dealt with some of these punitive damages. And he was telling me a story about how basically, you know, these jurors get so pissed and it's not their checkbook. And so they write big checks. And he was saying that that one time there was a trial and someone had lost a leg. And the jury had awarded, I think, like $200 million or $300 million for a lost leg. And he said to my friend as the clerk, he said, if I gave you $250 million, would you give me your leg below the knee? And he's like, hell yeah. And he's like, that's why I have to lower this. It shouldn't be a deal you'd take.
I mean, it is a bold thing for
her
to include.
Yeah,
that's very helpful. Yeah, that analogy helps. It's an article of faith among Republican voters, in part because of Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis and everyone who ran against Donald Trump, that all these trials are unfair and that the justice system is rigged against him. But I bet this is what she really believes. And I think she's making an important point here, which is that this is not just a handful of liberal judges going after Donnie T. These are juries, grand juries who are awarding damages, who are deciding if they should issue charges against him or not. And so, yeah, like some of this is like liberal people in liberal cities, but there's a grand jury in Southern Florida who thinks Donald Trump did some bad things. And maybe she's kind of like going to spell that out a little more.
Yeah, I do think it, leaning on the jury, I think that tells us something too about we've all seen these polls where when they ask people, you know, if Donald Trump is convicted, what do you think? And will you vote for him? And then suddenly like Joe Biden's winning the race, right? And I think that there is still widespread trust in juries, even if Donald Trump has radicalized the Republican Party against the justice system, courts, saying that everything's like, you know, Joe Biden and his DOJ trying to go after everyone. And I do think that as juries start finding him liable or potentially guilty on some of these charges, that, you know, it's not going to be as easy to just blame Joe Biden and Merrick Garland and the DOJ on this kind of stuff. And I think that's why she said that. And also, don't think that Donald Trump helped himself too much. You know, he's stormed out of court. His lawyer's yelling at the judge. Like, you're sitting there he thinks that his, like, tough guy, I'm strong, I'm going to yell at everyone. Like, that might work with, like, Republican-based voters. I think just, like, a jury sitting there listening to E. Jean Carroll and listening to Trump's lawyer and listening to all the evidence, like, they're going to think differently.
Yeah, I also, it's, you know, he, right now, like, yes, this may not ultimately redound to Nikki Haley being the Republican nominee. But on like Trump is getting it from Joe Biden and the Democrats, and Nikki Haley is hitting him pretty hard on this stuff. And I do think like that together, if that can keep going over the next couple months,
that'd be nice.
I like it.
Now
I like it.
Do you think she's veering too heavily into Chris Christie territory or is this the right message? From an analysis point, I mean, we obviously,
hey,
we you know on. How we think feel about Chris Christie's message, but
I mean, the old message had her taking third in Iowa and losing by 30 points. Yeah. So maybe switch it up. I support that. I mean, like, the writing might be on the wall, but we'll see. You know, maybe it's the hamburger from heaven. Maybe it's the court cases.
I also think that's like, when in doubt, make the strongest argument and tell the best story. I think she is not doing what Chris Christie, like, look, she's going much harder, but there is a care she does. Chris Christie was not playing for a majority. He just wasn't. But like you see when Nikki Haley is on stage, you watch her couch things based on conversations she's had or polling she's seen. Like there's a discipline to it, even when she's going really hard. Like she always throws in, like, I don't want to disparage anybody, but, or when she goes after. I mean, it's ridiculous.
But he's in decline.
But like, it's very clearly
that was
like
our defamation training. That's yeah. How you save yourself.
Yeah. What I've heard is
she'll endorse him by the convention. Who are we kidding?
I hate that I'm asking this question. Did you guys read that Ross Douthat column?
I'm so sorry. Nope. I'm so sorry. I'm not. So sorry, John. I didn't save you because I. Moments ago, I almost said, we've all read the Ross Douthat column. What was interesting is...
So yeah. Ross Douthat writes a column basically that said she is veering too heavily into Chris Christie territory.
Is it Douthat or Douthat?
I've never known.
Fine, sorry, going forward. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Sorry, Ross. Don't mean to disparage you. And he basically said she is veering too much into Chris Christie territory and that she should try to actually expand her coalition if she wants to win. And his advice is to like... She should be focusing on issues and criticizing Trump for like not getting enough done while he was president. My view on that is like Ron DeSantis tried that.
The thing that Ross wrote read like a Ron DeSantis stump speech.
Yeah,
I already
that's
had
what
that.
I thought.
And now I agree that Ron DeSantis' loss was overdetermined because he was terrible in every way humanly possible. But the other thing I took away from the Ross Douthat column, with which we're all familiar, is the part where she does either it's great minds or she read the column. She's making an elitist argument.
Yeah.
She makes
I was wondering if she got that from the yeah. column.
Listen, everybody's reading this column.
Tommy,
what do you think of Ross Douthat's column?
I didn't read it.
Bullshit.
This New York Times columnist should go to some Trump events and talk to the people there because they think he was a great president.
I know.
Who accomplished great things, and literally every poll and every focus group you'll ever watch says this. We'll tell you that.
Loved his presidency. Loved the policies.
Think he was amazing.
Think he won the election.
Yeah. That's where
if they have any complaints about him, it's the complaints that Nikki Haley is making, which is that he like throws
like
temper
tweets,
tantrum and can't control
like,
himself, stuff like that. That's the only thing that they might not like about him. And that's like a smaller percentage than you'd hope. Okay, before we go to break, quick housekeeping notes. Washington, D.C. is where we're kicking off Crooked's 2024 tour dates. Love It or Leave It will be coming to Washington on April 25th.
Hell yeah.
For a show at the Lincoln Theater. Tickets are available now.
They're selling.
Head to crooked.com/events to grab your tickets. Also, you don't need to wait till April to hear Love It's Best Takes.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God, what is this?
Tomorrow, January 31st, he'll be on the Friends of the Pod Discord at 2:30 Pacific time for an AMA.
All right, great. Cool.
All you have to do is be a Friends of the Pod member.
Sign
and
up.
if you're not, you should sign up at crooked.com/friends. You get to ask Love It questions. You get to listen to all of our other pod. Like Dan Pfeiffer's got a new Polar Coaster pod.
Yeah.
Terminally Online.
That pod's
all
great.
Kinds of great content. So sign up. Also, today is National Help America Vote Day. By becoming a poll worker, you can help strengthen our democracy and ensure free and fair elections this November. So head to powerthepolls.org/votesaveamerica. To sign up. Okay, let's talk about Joe Biden. He campaigned in South Carolina over the weekend. The first official Democratic primary takes place there on Saturday, though the president was mostly focused on his likely general election opponent, Donald Trump. The New York Times has a story about Biden's battle plan for the campaign, which apparently includes a focus on Trump, democracy, abortion, as well as a big surrogate operation of social media influencers, fundraisers with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, and a hoped-for endorsement from Taylor Swift. Biden
for $10,000, you meet Bill Clinton. For $20,000, you don't have to.
Wow.
Just kidding.
Biden went pretty hard at Trump during his speech in South Carolina. Let's listen.
Have you noticed? He's a little confused these days. He apparently can't tell the difference between Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi. Folks, the bottom line is our economy has grown more in the last 6 months than it ever did at any point in Trump's entire 4 years in office. Donald Trump refused to visit a cemetery, U.S. cemetery, outside of Paris for fallen American soldiers. And he referred to those heroes, and I quote, as suckers and losers. He actually said that. He said that. How dare he say that? How dare he talk about my son and all of us just like that? Look, I call them patriots and heroes. The only loser I see is Donald Trump. And you're the reason Donald Trump is a defeated former president. You're the reason Donald Trump is a loser. And you're the reason We're going to win and beat him again.
What did you guys think of the speech and the message?
It's good to see him at a rally, you know, and get some energy. You're not in the Rose Garden. You're not stuck at that terrible briefing room podium. Mm. That was good. Decided to unload the Oppo clip on Trump there. You know, he also hit him for saying Trump said he wanted to see the economy collapse for political reasons. Mm. He called him Donald Herbert Hoover Trump.
Nice.
Zinger.
That's going to stick.
I like hitting him on the Pelosi-Haley confusion. I think that's...
Did you feel
you want to call me senile?
It's broken.
How about
through?
That? Yeah. How about this? I'll call you
I'm
senile.
I'm rubber, you're glue, you old fuck. did you think that there was a sentence that was supposed to come after the Haley-Pelosi line? He just sort of made reference to it, but he didn't describe it.
Well, if you listen to the speech, it's a hard transition to the border right after
that's
that.
That's what I know.
A really hard transition.
It felt like there was something missing. Maybe there was more to the hit. He skipped it. I don't know.
There was a couple times where there was some assumed knowledge. Like at one point he said to the crowd, "Did you see that article about Snickers?" And they were like, "No."
It's about shrinkflation. Do you know about shrinkflation?
It was not bad than the New York Times. Anyway,
right next to the Ross Duth
column. It probably was.
Well, no, listen, hey, the shrinkflation is real, all right? They're making these peanut butter jars.
It's all good.
They're making these peanut butter jars. They're hiding it. You know, they make the divot on the bottom bigger. So the jar looks bigger, less peanut butter inside.
And the reason he asked about Snickers is that apparently Snickers bars are a little bit smaller now, but the same price.
I also think that part of that op-ed was about how the prices of things like a Snickers are not going down as fast as the price of a TV. So if you're buying a Snickers, you're seeing it's $1.20 now when it used to be $1, and you're still kind of pissed off about inflation, even though more broadly inflation's decreasing. Yeah. Anyway.
And it's the corporation's fault, right?
Because
there's no supply chain issue
greedy
that's making Snickers shrink their bars.
No, it's not just, that we know of.
Yeah,
but a lot
and
of it was,
one thing this country needs is gigantic Snickers bars.
You got to be satisfied.
That's his platform.
All right, I'm in. I had a Snickers this weekend, and it was great.
Okay, so I mean, were you going to say something?
No, I mean broadly. I mean, a lot of the speech was focused on accomplishments. There was a riff on promise made, promise kept. It wasn't a ton of here's what I'm going to do if you reelect me in a second term. As compared to what Trump would do. But, you know, that's going to take some time to flesh out, I think.
Yeah, I think, first of all, it was just nice to see just like a hard hit on Donald Trump. I do think it was a bit of like a catch-all without, like, there wasn't a story to the hits on Trump. Like, Haley goes out there, the other person giving speeches across the country hitting Trump this week. But Haley goes out there, she starts with Trump right away, and she says, you know, Trump's out for himself. He's thinking about himself. He's not thinking about you. And then she kind of goes into it. There wasn't that kind of cohesive story to the critique of Trump, and it didn't tie back to the promises made, promises kept section. It felt like just a few chunks of different things they were putting together to try out. I liked the parts that they were trying out.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I mean, what I liked about the speech, delivery, lively and energetic, great to see. It was a tight 24-minute speech. Love a sub 30-minute speech from anyone. He went hard at Trump. That's great. I think it was focused too heavily on reciting a list of his accomplishments and too heavily on Trump's character, too heavily on what Trump's done in the past. Like, I think that it's great to do the troops line, but like that's from years ago, an Atlantic piece, and it's just seems old now. What is missing is a story about what Biden's trying to do for the country versus what Trump's trying to do to the country. Like, I really like Biden's let's finish the job slogan, but now he's got to talk about the job he wants to finish and talk about how he's going to finish it. He had there was a tweet last week where he talked about it on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and on abortion, his message is great. It's very specific. Give me a bigger Democratic majority. I will codify Roe v. Wade. That's simple. People get it. That can go for the entire agenda. And he should say, like, we've done a lot. Trump has Republicans in Congress blocking everything for politics, even a border deal that they wanted. Get rid of Trump. Give me a bigger majority and we can solve a lot of our problems. And that also speaks to some of the disappointment that some voters might have that he didn't do more. He didn't get more done. You have a whole Republican Congress to blame that is being led around by Donald Trump. Like,
yeah.
You got to tell us. It's got to be about the future.
One of the write-ups of their plan is around this speech is there were some Biden advisors basically saying that they want to fight on the economy to a draw, so that they can be more on their turf where they feel like they can win, which is democracy, extremism, abortion. And I think I felt like that's what this speech was about. Like the promises made, promises kept. I do think that they must be seeing, we're all seeing it, a ton of polling that shows people have Forget the stuff that Republicans blocked. They have no idea what Joe Biden got done in the last few years. I see it myself. Like, there's a ton of misinformation around, like, student debt, for example. Like, one, you know, the last week he issued that decision that would cancel another $5 billion in debt. And there's a ton of stuff circulating on social media that says, oh, Biden has only canceled $5 billion of student debt. That's like less than 0.5% of the outstanding debt, which just isn't true and misses the billions and billions and billions he's canceled for millions of people. And so I don't know what the answer is there. I agree with you. Like, Tim Walz spoke to some reporter and said that, you know, this, the choice is democracy and freedom versus extremism and chaos, right? Like, that to me is like a simple frame, like that, that is clearly running through this speech, but wasn't laid out in this speech. And you have to get to the choice. But I, you know, the, they clearly want more people to understand what he got done.
Even on the student loan stuff, he started to tell the story of what he's been doing and what he hopes to do, right? He was like, I wanted to cancel all student debt. The Supreme Court blocked me. I said, fine, I'm going to just do as much as I can on my own. But give me a bigger Democratic majority. They can send me a bill and I'll cancel the rest in the second term, right? Like, you've got to, even the accomplishments are fine to talk about, but you got to put the accomplishments in the context of
finishing
what your
job.
Vision is, what you're trying to do, so people understand the story. Because otherwise, it's just a list of policies that people are going to be like, what?
Yeah.
I think, the ship has passed, and I think getting credit for the things he feels like he didn't have credit for. I do think, you know, Biden's got a nail biter coming up. Emerson poll in early January had him at 69%, Dean Phillips at 5%. Marianne Williamson at 3, so he's got to get that
did
over
you
the
guys,
finish line.
Did you guys see, so Dean Phillips also spoke at this event that Biden was at because it is a Democratic primary, and the guy was, it's a painful clip, it was him trying to get everyone's attention because everyone's like walking out of the room and eating, and he's like, can I just get your attention for 2 minutes, just 2 minutes.
It was like trying to sell you a car.
You have 2 minutes of, for 2 minutes of your time, I'm going to refer to some New York Times polls you may not have seen.
What did you guys make of the Time story? You guys feeling good about the battle plan? Any other advice you want to give from here in the cheap seats?
My favorite part of that story is that they had to tell people applying for social media jobs to stop telling them that they wanted to get Taylor Swift's endorsement, and basically just sort of like, we agree, it would be nice, we've heard enough ideas on that, please do not reference that in your strategy deck.
What's your posting strategy, huh?
Yeah.
Don't tell me about your Taylor Swift strategy, tell me about your posting
strategy.
We all
want Taylor Swift on board. Everybody wants Taylor Swift in the tent.
It's tough for the people who applied. I was glad to hear that they're staffing up quickly. The campaign team now is 100 members, and they have staff in 6 swing states and South Carolina for the primary. It also sounds like the surrogate focus is beyond just Taylor Swift. It's not just elected officials, but it's like micro-influencers and, you know, people who have Instagram followings that you've never heard of but matter a lot in their community. So like, that'll matter. You know, they're betting that concerns about Trump outweigh concerns about Biden's age. We'll see. I don't know.
I do, you know, Democratic candidate X should have a better surrogate operation is like one of the oldest complaints in politics. I do think it's especially important this time, since Biden is so unpopular and there will likely be third party options for people to go to. And it's also going to be really tough to get people's attention just because of the way the media is and because everyone's like, oh, are we having this rerun race again, right? So I do think you need the biggest coalition possible of notable people who can build a permission structure for different groups of voters to think it's okay to vote for Joe Biden again, even if they're not super thrilled about it. Taylor Swift for young people who aren't sure if they're going to vote. Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney for Republicans who don't like Trump but are like not so sold on Joe Biden, like AOC and Bernie for disappointed progressives. Like, you just need as many people out there on the field as possible saying like, we need to do this. This is good. This is for us. It's not about Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It's about the country, you know.
Tippecanoe had Tyler too, you know, the original.
Yeah, for
sure. Tommy's been waiting to unleash that one.
You're playing the bongos over there, man.
Just
hammer.
Sorry.
No. I thought it was funny.
Audiophile over here. This guy. He's like that guy in that
boat. Cut them responding aggressively to my job.
Yeah, the response was aggressive.
I really hope Biden wins.
Taylor Swift did endorse him in 2020.
Yeah, she did. Also. She endorsed, and she's also used her Instagram to like get a ton of people to register to vote. So like, she's been out there.
Yeah, she does the more like, I'm voting. She did it more subtly in
2020. She's very focused on Tennessee. And
I think for this time around, she'd want to be, like, the Biden campaign probably wanted to be a little more forceful.
Yes. And by the way, like, it's not like it. I hope the Biden campaign figures out how to coax Taylor out of her den like a scared lost puppy. But like, it's also on Taylor Swift. Like, hey, you just did the biggest tour ever. You
made some references to politics in some places as part of the tour, but it was a largely apolitical tour, and you built up a ton of goodwill, and it's like, it's time to spend it, you know? Yeah. The country needs you. It's like, that's it. And like,
you're the Black Mirror of the people yelling at her for ruining the NFL. I like this. Let's just heap
those
responsibility on this woman.
Well, yeah, I think with great power comes great responsibility. Do you not agree with that statement? Or
also,
have you not read a comic book?
Those are like loud, annoying voices on social media. Like most people are like, oh, I love Taylor Swift or I love football, and they watch it. That's it.
Yeah, I do think. Yeah,
that's most people in the country.
And anyone mad about Taylor Swift appearing in their screens for like 15 seconds over the course of a 3-hour game? You know,
the biggest babies in the world.
Yeah, go outside and maybe ask your mom what it's like to be a woman.
So that's the campaign. One challenge every president running for re-election has to deal with is unexpected events that divert attention from your message and campaign plans. That has obviously been happening to Biden with the war in Gaza. It just escalated over the weekend when Iran-backed militias killed and wounded American troops in Jordan. Biden said in South Carolina on Sunday when he was in church that the U.S. will be responding. And a lot of Republicans are already demanding that he hit Iran hard. I think Tom Cotton said he'd be a coward if he didn't hit Tehran.
Sounds right.
And Lindsey Graham's been going after him. Trump's been going after him on this. Tommy, what's your level of concern over what might happen next year?
Extremely high. I mean, over the weekend, this was the first time that U.S. troops have been killed and 30 were wounded. So this is like a big attack. But it's just the most recent of, I think the last count was 150 attacks on U.S. troops by these Iranian-linked proxy groups in Iraq and Syria. And then on top of that, you have the Houthi rebels firing at ships all through the Red Sea. The U.S. has been hammering targets in Yemen itself since January 11th, basically a daily basis. So this, you know, because of these Iranian proxy group responses to what's happening in Gaza, the tensions in the region have been going up and up and up and up. And I think the White House is probably deciding, okay, do we hit like IRGC bases, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard bases in Syria or Iraq, or do we actually hit targets in Iran itself? And that is a pretty scary, terrible choice to have to make. Or not, frankly, they don't have to make it. They could not respond if they want to, but I suspect they are going to, and they're going to do so in a pretty heavy way.
Man, this unyielding supporter of Bibi Netanyahu is really paying dividends, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's the frustrating part is, you know, I know that they're working very hard to get a ceasefire in Gaza. There's all these reports that they're like close to getting a 1 month or 2 month ceasefire. But, you know, I think we should take the Houthi rebels and some of these other groups at their word that part of the impetus for this increase in attacks on U.S. forces is because of what's happening in Gaza. And if you can get a ceasefire there, hopefully a permanent one, and get the hostages back, then you could ratchet down tensions everywhere in the Middle East. But
yeah,
we'll see.
And of course, Trump's critiques on this are all bullshit, right? He's like, this never would have happened if I was president.
I mean, who knows, right? It's just like the simplest, stupidest thing to say.
He also said today or yesterday that the stock market is up because I'm doing so well in the polls that it's for me.
Investors are saying Trump's going to win. And so we're all excited. So that the stock
Trump, when the stock market's up, that's Trump. When the stock market's down, that's Biden. When the jobs are up, that's Trump. When the jobs are down, that's Biden.
Yeah, I mean, Trump likes to pretend that the Iranians weren't doing very similar things when he was president. They absolutely were. He's just, you know, he's exploiting everything he can for maximum political gain, including the death of U.S. troops.
Going to be a fun year, guys. Yep. Going to be a fun campaign. Well, that's all we have for today. We will talk to you again on Wednesday, and that's it.
See you at the movies.
See you at the movies. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. And if you're already doom scrolling, don't forget to follow us at Pod Save America on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. Plus, if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Olivia Martinez and David Toledo. Our associate producers are Saul Rubin and Farah Safari. Kira Joachim is our senior producer. Reed Cherlin is our executive producer. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Writing support by Hallie Kiefer. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Mia Kelman, David Tolles, Kirill Pelaviv, and Molly Lobel.